woman, gonna mess your mind. American woman, gonna mess your mind. American woman, gonna mess your mind.
Stay away from me. evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. This week is a special one for UMFM, as it is our annual Pledge-O-Rama fundraising campaign, and we have incredible lineups on all of our shows to highlight our amazing and entertaining programming. Pledge-O-Rama kicked off at 6:30 p.m. on April 24th and runs through to 8 p.m. on May 1st. UMFM is listener-supported radio. Radio by the listener, for the listener. All the content you hear on UMFM, from music, sports, and news coverage to the spoken word shows, are heard throughout the University of Manitoba campus, local Winnipeg, and online communities. The shows are delivered with passion by the UMFM team and over 120 volunteers who genuinely love what they do. And if you love the wide selection of programming and the minimal advertisements on UMFM, let us know by calling 204-474-6610 or by going online to umfm.com/donate and showing your support for what UMFM is, listener-supported radio. Again, that number is 204-474-6610 or umfm.com/donate. To highlight the types of interviews you will hear on Art World Innovators, here's an interview from earlier this season with Becca Sturgis, Principal Landscape Architect and partner at Reed Hildebrand Landscape Architecture based in the U.S. Becca gives us an in-depth look at her story and the passion behind what she does as a landscape architect. Our guest this evening is Becca Sturgis, Principal Landscape Architect and partner at Reed Hildebrand Landscape Architecture based in Cambridge, Massachusetts and New Haven, Connecticut. Becca opened their New Haven, Connecticut office in 2015, leading a number of private and public projects such as their work with Yale University, Storm King Art Center in New York, and Dumbarton Oaks Research Library in Washington, D.C. Reed Hildebrand has been highly recognized with over 70 prestigious awards. Becca was also the lead project landscape architect for the award-winning expansion of the Clark Art Institute in the Berkshires and the renewal of the Smithsonian's Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden in Washington, D.C. Becca graduated from Sarah Lawrence College in New York with a Bachelor of Arts in English, began a doctorate in English Literature at Princeton University when she discovered landscape architecture. She then graduated from the Harvard School of Design with a Master of Landscape Architecture. Becca is a professor and senior critic at the Yale University School of Architecture and Connecticut College and is often called upon to lecture nationally and internationally at highly recognized institutions and events. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be with you.
One of your current collaborative projects is a major expansion of the Storm King Art Center in New York State. Can you tell us more about your vision and innovative design plans for this project?
I would love to. We have had the opportunity to be working with Storm King since 2017, growing in our knowledge of how they think about the relationship of the environment and art, land, site-specific commissions, and then other emerging temporary possibilities. One of the things that I think for Storm King has become a major interest is how to make the experience of arriving at Storm King one that feels really welcoming and both, I would say, exciting and maybe surprising, but enough familiar or organized in terms of what is expected of you as a visitor that people who maybe have not ever been to a sculpture garden before or don't typically go to museums, they feel really glad that they're there. They're supposed to be there. And so that there have been many ways from trying to figure out all this dramatic topography and so much ground that you can cover when you go as a visitor. So there have been questions about how do you make this campus or these grounds, how do you make them accessible? And that's been something that they've been working hard at for years and have enrolled many people to think about it. And similarly, the question of what does it really mean to introduce and make present for people ecology and the relationship between all the insects and plants and animals that we share our environment with? How can that be a fundamental part of your experience going to see works of art and sculpture? That's also been a question that they've been asking for so long. And Daryl Morrison, who's an amazing ecologist and meadow expert, preceded our involvement there. So these sort of questions of how do you think about ecology and sculpture or a visitor experience and tall grasses and bugs, those are questions that they've been asking for a long time. But I think it just seems basically after 2010, all the interest and questioning of how can museums be really relevant and how is art something that helps us understand the major issues of our time? I think they realized that being more explicit about welcome and that all people should come and be glad and happy and take away whatever it is that they discover and then hopefully come back again. That, I think, just became a core mission and a driver for them. And so they launched their first capital campaign. And so this project that you're talking about, we have been working on very specific small projects to help with these issues about how to think about the environment and art or how to think about accessibility or what does equity mean for Storm King and for this place. But this capital project is so exciting because that's really the mission of the project. And so they have brought together a really phenomenal team led by Henneken Peng, or sometimes referred to as H-Park out of Dublin, and with WXY, another great practice. They're the architects of record from New York City. Also a phenomenal practice out of London called Gustafson Porter Bowman. And I think all of these are landscape architects like us. And basically all of these different folks have come together to try and figure out how do you make the experience of one of the number one problems in a situation like this is people come from far away, either sometimes by bus or by train or by car, and they have to go to the bathroom. And in a way, this is really embarrassing reality of what it means to be a guest at a place that is a kind of landscape destination. And so I think how to almost make the architecture this very, very quiet, graceful backdrop where it's really the landscape setting that you understand, and then that there is a singular path whereby you can get your ticket, you can get a drink, so you're a little bit refreshed and you can wash your hands. There are benches to sit down if you're waiting for someone. All of this has been quite a confused and ad hoc set of experiences up till this point. So now we have this one wonderful gathering funnel, and we're saying that we've understood it to be within what we're calling the forest frame, and it's right next to the wetland. So the issues of what is the significance of a wetland and what are all the species and pollinators, all of that, that are in the wetland, that's now going to be very much foregrounded. And then this amazing work by Calder is in your sight line and greets you as you go forth onto the main part of the ground.
Have the collaborators and the team had any input or ideas from other sculpture parks?
I think absolutely. I think that sort of question of what are our peer organizations doing? Are there some really important standards? It's always an interesting question when you are a groundbreaking organization yourself. There's this delight and pride about the things that you've come up with and have set the standard for. And then a natural evolution is that then all sorts of great younger organizations start up and they innovate on things that you've done. And suddenly there are ways in which you've fallen behind. And so I think Storm King very much was interested in not just looking at arts organizations, but looking at national parks or other places that take what the public or what very diverse audiences need to feel welcome and recognized seriously. And I think actually what's been interesting is in some cases, it's been memorials or again, some of these sort of exceptional world landscape destinations that they've turned to understand how are we really going to take seriously what people need. I think it's actually been much less about the art itself, because that I think they're quite confident about. It's much more about what's the minimum requirement to make basically all people feel comfortable and welcome.
So how does the landscape architecture enhance or create a closer relationship between art and nature and some of the open art galleries?
So I think something that we have focused on with this project is if you are a guest at Storm King and you arrive, one of the things that people talk the most about are the views out to the mountains and this incredible rolling topography with these wide meadows and the grasses, you know, wherever the wind. And then there are some truly giant works of art. One is more than 100 feet in its scale, right? That are set with this backdrop of dramatic mountains or hills. That's what people expect when they come to Storm King. What we became very interested in, which I think feels very relevant for all of us today, is what's the edge or what's the frame for this condition? So we are not really changing that experience of the meadows and the long distant view of the hills behind. What we're really focused on is what do you see in the foreground and how do you understand that experience of actually being on the edge as important? And what are the habitats of the forest and the wetlands and the riparian edge? And we're getting to daylight a stream that's been buried for a long time as part of this project. And what does that mean if suddenly, right, all of the waters that go around us are underneath us because we've paved over them, start to be more present and we work with them? So I think it feels very relevant to us to say, look, the edge is a great opportunity. And there are all sorts of things that you can perceive and enjoy and think through. It can become unfamiliar and familiar at once, making friends with being on the edge or being at the outside. I think that's a really interesting part of this project, and we really enjoyed it. And so there is this procession through the edge that is the welcome experience.
You have been involved in a number of projects with other various art institutes. Can you tell us a little more about those?
I would love to. I think something that happens early in our relationships with most museums or arts organizations or artists that we work with is trying to understand what about the existing collection or what about the particular approach of an artist has a resonance or radical difference from the landscape condition that we're working with. So in some cases, there's actually a similarity. So at our work at the Clark Art Institute in Williamstown, Massachusetts, they have an incredible Innes collection and many works that are pastoral in one way or another, in a really wonderful landscape collection. And that landscape is still, in some parts of it, a working agricultural landscape. And so cows are pastured in the meadows and on the hillside, and there's a little ag pond right outside the window of one of the main galleries. And so you can be looking at works and you can be seeing a landscape that is of today and of the future, but it has amazing parallels with what you're actually looking at when you look at works in a collection. That's one situation where we play with that, to play with your sense of time and to make history in some ways come forward a little bit. I mean, landscape has really interesting timescales, and that's something that we try to really play with when we're working with our arts organizations. So that's just one example. I can share a little bit about our work at NOMA, the New Orleans Museum of Art, where we get to work at the Best of Sculpture Garden. And I think New Orleans is one of the most fun places to go as a visitor. And it's an amazing, although I think more complicated place if you actually live there. But one of the really serious parts about living or even visiting in New Orleans is understanding flooding and what it means to have the Delta of the Mississippi there. That arts museum, that sculpture collection is in one of the great parks of New Orleans, a very large park. And the work that we got to do there came after a sculpture project. I think it's about 10 or 15 years old now, but in some ways was about making rooms for sculpture, sort of formal galleries. And we saw a great opportunity for this project that we got to work on to actually work with the lagoon. Because the park doesn't, in some ways, although a lot of flood management happens there, it a little bit denies the realities of the floodwaters and all of those ecologies. And then the garden room strategy for the sculpture also, while really wonderful and giving you a very focused way of understanding the works of sculpture, it isn't about thinking about the ecology and the realities of what, all this moving water and the lagoon and art. And so that was an opportunity in our reading of the land and the ecology where we said, let's make this all about those ecologies and all about that changing water system. And people have really loved it. because it is a place in the city where you can get close to that. And so much of the time in New Orleans, you can't be close to those realities, even though they weigh on you.
Can you tell us a little bit about your own academic background and what inspired you to follow a career in landscape architecture?
Sure. That's thoughtful of you to ask. I think I am a person who has always been happiest outside, and we all have things about ourselves that really drive us, right? And so I've always wanted to do something where I was able to be outside. I know for me that I think part of what I love about being outside is how much is moving all of the time around me and how much of that is so much larger than our human selves and our human communities. And so I think the idea of getting to work with plants, but also by extension, birds and butterflies and even beetles or snakes, I'm really interested in all the species that come together and that you get to think about and that are moving through places when you get to be outside. And the other thing I would just share, which I know must be deeply important to my motivation about becoming a landscape architect, is that so many of my happiest moments as a young person were going on walks outside in parks or woods with my mother or each of my grandmothers. And so I think that sense of when you're a body in motion with people that you know and that you love, something different happens when you're outside and you're going on a journey together. And I think that sort of sense of how human relationships are maybe a little bit different when you're outside than when you're inside and you're able to have a shared experience, but it's not bounded and maybe the rules are a little bit more relaxed. All of that is really interesting and exciting to me.
You had a background in English as well as the landscape architecture and design. How does that combination contribute to your practice?
I love your question. I think I'm not sure I fully know. I'll offer some speculations maybe. One is I just love stories and I love plot lines and I love twists. And I think when you're a designer trying to make something come to be with a group of other people, there's a lot of friction and resistance and surprise. And the sense of each project is like a little novel or drama in and of itself. And I think my sense of being able to keep the perspective of like, yeah, we're one voice, we're one actor, we're part of an assemblage or something. I think there are a lot of parallels there. The other thing I might offer is that I think landscape systems, whether you're talking about water, the way wind, climate operate, or earth, soil, or plants, they don't speak. And as a consequence, we haven't done a very good job, I think, understanding how they really work or what perhaps they really need to not become dangerous or difficult or overly resistant. I sometimes think we do a lot of drawing and drawing is really useful. And now we have all these amazing 3D digital tools to work with too. But words are really, really powerful for how we understand things. I think the English background has helped me in some ways try to translate what I can learn from ecologists or other scientists or learn from other design practitioners and try to get what environmental conditions may need and what humans may need to come together. Those are maybe the two things I would offer up.
Reid Hildebrand has been highly recognized with numerous prestigious awards. Can you tell us maybe about a couple of the award-winning projects and describe your approach that has earned such acclaim?
So I think we try to be just, in general, very close listeners and close readers of conditions and situations and needs. And as a consequence, to the extent that we sort of have a method, that maybe is the method. And then what we try to do is document, draw through what we've understood about what those conditions are or needs are. So we'll often draw through what's the geological substructure that is creating all the conditions, and then follow the line, a droplet of water, where does it go? How is it going to behave? What's affecting its behavior? And then at the same time, like, you're an organization or you're a city, and suddenly the train station has moved or will move, and you have 10,000 people a day. They're not coming here anymore. They're going to be coming over here, or now they're split into two. And how can we anticipate or understand the behavior that humans are bringing to a situation? And so we try to, I would say, in general, just to understand whether it's at the scale of the Hirshhorn, which is on the National Mall and sees about a million people a year come through, which is a lot of people, or even we do residential work and working with people to understand their homes and whether or not they have a dog or whether or not their mother lives with them or will come for a month at a time or not. And is she blind? Or there are all of these questions and realities that we really try to pay a huge amount of attention to. I think a project that's really celebrated, which is very small, is a project that we did on an old quarry site on the coast of Connecticut. And it's interesting from an art point of view because it's one of the few works of architecture that Tony Smith, the sculptor, ever made. And it's a very strict, very abstract, it's a sort of box floating above a perfect concrete plinth. And the landscape is the most unruly. It was the most ragged, messy, sort of brambly place you ever saw. And it feels like it's on a rocky island in Canada or Maine, but it happens to actually, it's a funny granite moment on the coast of Connecticut. And so the question was, this was a sort of question, like, do you try to bring a level of abstraction that is clean and ordered and filled with lines to be playing with this work of art, architecture? Or is this a place where actually the wildness and the ruggedness of the land and that resistance feels more important to bring forward? And working with a client, clients who are both trained as architects and one is a world-renowned architect, we came up with the sense that we're going to let the landscape be really different. We don't want them to be at all the same. And as much as possible, even when we have lines in the landscape, we hold them off. There's like a gesture of respect and difference, not even touching the architecture. But then it felt like we were too rough. And so there were a couple of places where these lines became very important. We set as a rule that we're going to, if we could use only stone found from the tailings of the quarry on site, and it was the way that we would work with it that would show an intention of living with that roughness and waste. And so for that project, the stones in between these two small buildings are laid like scales that you step over and cross. And in that moment, you don't even touch those stones either. That's maybe another example.
As a professor and critic, what do you find most rewarding about teaching at Yale and other speaking engagements?
So teaching is basically an endless act of humility. If I feel like this was said to me about a bazillion times, teachers say, well, I learn from you. I do really feel like I learn so much from my students. One of the things teaching at a school of architecture where there is not actually a landscape architecture department, I think I often am amazed by how much of a backdrop or how invisible so much of the environment is in the way many people understand shelter and understand what are humans responsible for when they think about design. And so I think simultaneously, the humility, I guess I learned, is like they simultaneously know so much and they speak with so much wisdom. And yet at the same time, there's so much about landscape and just how water works and how soil works and what plants need that I have that opportunity to share. And I think, I guess maybe in some way for me, the most joyful moments in teaching come from the sense of getting to share something I care enormously about and that I've been gaining knowledge about for quite a while. And then just in class on Tuesday, I stayed late to help some students think about how they were drawing what we call landform, which is shaped topography, made topography. And they were laughing at me because I was grinning from ear to ear. I was so happy. It's a kind of gift giving is how I often think of it when it's working well.
Do you have any exciting projects coming up that you can share with our audience?
We have a number of very exciting projects. I mean, the Storm King one is where we began, as an example. We have another one, actually, that I'm just coming from a meeting about, which is a new exhibition space and a new little park in downtown Santa Fe for the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. Really, really exciting set of questions and potentials with that project. But the project that I also have a meeting on today that I think speaks to many of the questions that we're all thinking about right now is a new project in Texas. And it's for a family that is also making a new institution at the same time. And the goal of the organization is to connect particularly the Black community in Dallas and that area with what it means to grow food and the environment and to also cook and eat delicious food. But the relationship between plants and growing and cooking and eating and then your own health and the happiness and outcomes for your community, when you understand all of those things, is really, really exciting. So there's a big piece of really beautiful piece of land that they have about an hour outside of Dallas. And really starting to get to think about how do we make this the most ecologically vibrant place possible? And then what gets grown and where do kids come and what do they learn and how does that all work? It feels like an incredibly exciting, incredibly generous project that seeks to really deal with one of the more difficult challenges that we have, which is how do we help kids lead healthy lives and make good choices about their bodies and their preferences? So,
how would you advise students that are interested in pursuing a career in landscape architecture?
There are so many different potential paths to landscape architecture. And I think for students who love that,